Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Hello and welcome to Unheard. I'm Freddie Sayers. We're at day 7 of the conflict in Ukraine and we're still trying to work out exactly what is going on. There's almost an eerie atmosphere that it hasn't fully got going yet. In order to help us understand that and why that might be, we're joined this morning by Justin Bronk. He is a research fellow at the Royal United Services Institute and is a specialist in military science and air power in particular. Hi, Justin.
Good morning.
Is it fair then, would you agree that even though we're on day 7, there's a sense that the majority of the Russian military might, in particular their air force, simply hasn't yet been used? Why is that?
It's certainly true that the majority of their air force has so far basically sat on the ground in this conflict, which is quite surprising. There's a few reasons why that might be, but it is also worth noting that on the ground side of things, the initial picture where we had essentially very, very poorly coordinated columns of Russian forces, as well as sort of advanced assaults by paratroopers being inserted by helicopters, which went dreadfully for the Russians. And that was supposed to kind of reinforce an internal decapitation attempt against the Ukrainian government by infiltrated special forces and operatives. That didn't work. But we are seeing a shift with a lot more of Russian ground combat power now engaged. About 80% of their forces massed around Ukraine have crossed the border, according to US intelligence. And we're starting to see a lot of bombardment of cities, particularly Kharkiv in the north and down south, Mariupol, Melitopol, and Kherson. Although around Kiev, they're still pausing and building up. Basically, the Russian ground forces started off going in as sort of basically assuming they weren't going to have to fight their way into the cities. But that now is changing. We're likely to see the way the Russian army actually fights as it kind of would intend to over the next few days.
What do you mean by that, the way the Russian army actually fight? This is this thing that people refer to, that their sort of habits in Syria, places like Aleppo and Homs, where they would literally flatten entire neighborhoods of cities. Are we actually expecting that in Ukraine?
Unfortunately, yes. The Russian army is very much an artillery and firepower-based force. They don't really have the level of training, professionalism, exercise opportunities to take what we might call a maneuverist approach to warfare, where you're trying to basically exploit movement and you know, dynamically shape the battle space that way as much as with firepower. So something like the US Army, for example, or the British Army in its heyday would have done that. The Russians tend to do a much more set piece approach to warfare. They line up in these what they call battalion tactical groups, which are groups of about 1,000 troops, each with all the kind of enablers they need: tanks, armored personnel carriers, artillery, electronic warfare, air defense. And then they kind of push forward until they run out of steam, and then the next battalion tactical group will kind of go past them. We haven't seen that up to now. What we've seen instead is sort of these weird, almost unsupported in many cases, columns going forward on the roads, trying to rapidly encircle the cities, really clearly not expecting a fight, and also clearly with very little actual time to plan. It looks like the Russian military was given very, very short notice of actually moving to combat operations. And so there's been very little coordination. That is starting to change. So while the Ukrainians have seen magnificent success in many cases, they're showing extraordinary resistance, they haven't really faced the Russian military how it would plan to fight. And unfortunately, particularly around Kiev, what we're seeing is this pause, this large-scale buildup with these huge columns coming towards Kiev. The Russian army is sort of drawing itself up to actually fight how it would intend to fight if it, you know, was facing resistance, which
There's talk of a column that's 40 miles long. Is that credible? And how many troops would that include, roughly?
So, I mean, there are tens of thousands of troops being pushed through in these long columns. The slow pace and the kind of traffic jam nature of it indicates, A, relatively poor planning and poor logistics on the part of the Russians, but also perhaps as an indicator of one of the factors we're seeing across the board on the ground, which is very poor morale among Russian troops. They don't seem to really want to be there. They don't seem to want to fight. They don't really know what's going on at the kind of tactical level.
What's the evidence for that? Because people talk about that quite often. What actual hard evidence is there of low Russian morale?
So there's a few ones. First of all, there's a very high number of prisoners being taken in the first few days. And there's a pretty consistent narrative among those prisoners saying, you know, we didn't know we were going into combat. We don't really know what we're doing here. We haven't had any communications. We were supposed to be on exercise. There's also been a huge amount of Russian equipment, including some really quite modern and up-to-date heavy armor and things that have just been abandoned by their crews. They haven't run out of fuel. They've just been abandoned. And so Ukrainian civilians in many cases are kind of taking it upon themselves to either burn or capture this stuff. But that's not something you'd see in an army with you know, a decent morale. And you know, the general kind of level of aggression you'd expect to see from Russian forces based on their performance in previous conflicts isn't really there, except for a few specialist units, the paratroopers, the special forces, and the sort of Chechen units, which, for example, around Kherson yesterday seem to have made a lot of progress. But for the majority of Russian forces, not much morale. They don't seem to want to really be there.
So tell us about this air force mystery, because they have a large air force, right? Give us a sense of the numbers of aircraft involved in the Russian air force. I mean, it's much, much bigger than the Ukrainian force, right?
Yeah, so the Russian air force is massed around 300, slightly over, about 310 modern combat aircraft around Ukraine. A lot of those are part of the southern and western military districts, so the two military districts around that surround Ukraine anyway. So that a lot of it's the kind of standing force there, but they've also moved squadrons in from regiments in their case.
And what would Ukraine have by way of comparison?
So Ukraine started off with around 30 or so MiG-29, so relatively old short-range air superiority machines, and about 20 or so Sukhoi 27s. They've probably lost about half that, both in the ground and in the air. They also had a small number of Sukhoi 25 ground attack jets, of which they've certainly lost one or two. We don't really know, at least I don't really know what the status is on the remaining ones.
So we're talking about vastly, bombs. Vastly outnumbered.
Yeah, very outnumbered. But Ukraine does have a reasonable number of medium and short range mobile surface to air missile systems. We would say SA-11s, SA-15, one or two, and SA-8s. Those still seem to be active, although they're operating as a sort of pop-up threat. Their long-range surface-to-air missiles, some old S-300 batteries, seem to have been destroyed pretty early on, or at least heavily degraded by those initial Russian cruise missile strikes.
So this seems to be the biggest mystery of this whole war so far. We're admittedly only a week into it. You've got a vast Russian air force, and then you have this relatively small Ukrainian air force. Why did the Russians not just assume air superiority and control the skies from day one?
This is a huge mystery in the sense of not only why didn't they do it on day one, haven't they done it since then? Essentially, typically you'd expect to see in any modern war whoever it's fought by, really, you would expect to see exactly what we saw initially, which is a standoff bombardment with cruise missiles and ballistic missiles to kind of blind those early warning radars.
And that means taking out the radar system in the country you're trying to invade.
Yeah, so Ukraine had a number of ground-based long-range radars, so they would be kind of creating that big picture to direct the rest of the Air Force operations and the surface-to-air missiles. The Russians took almost all of those out on in the first couple of hours with standoff missile strikes, which is exactly what we'd expect to see. They also hit a number of air bases and long-range missile systems with strikes. But we didn't then see this expected follow-up large-scale air raids to wipe out the Ukrainian Air Force on the ground as it was then blinded and in some cases probably temporarily trapped by crater taxiways and things, and with fighters to kind of sweep up any Air Force, Ukrainian Air Force jets that did manage to take off that would then be sort of basically flying blind. We didn't see this. The only explanation I can really come up with that fits everything in my head on the first day is that basically they were given too little warning, which would fit with the uncoordinated nature of the ground attack and what we're hearing from a lot of prisoners that they, this was supposed to be on exercise. They had almost no warning. You can't spin up an air force for complex strike operations in a couple of hours. It's not just that aircraft need to be armed up. It's also that all the maintenance schedules need to be brought together and optimized so you have everything ready for kind of go time. And you also have to do loads and loads of flight planning, mission planning, plan how, for example, you're going to deconflict your Air Force operations with your ground-based surface-to-air missiles so that you don't get friendly fire, how all of the timings are going to work together so that aircraft don't run into each other while striking, particularly at night. All of this stuff doesn't seem to have been done, and it may be that they just didn't have enough time to do this when we started.
Just to push back on that, if I may, it just seems a little bit strange. I mean, we had weeks of talk of this imminent invasion. We had the military's been building up for months. Putin made his speech in advance. The whole thing seems to have progressed at quite a stately pace. Doesn't seem rushed. Why would they not have had enough time?
So it's likely, I think, that this is a result of the Russian kind of determination to stick with the playbook that they clearly had brought up at the strategic level, which US intelligence and, in fact, UK intelligence as well, was very active in kind of basically briefing to everybody in the weeks running up to the invasion. And yet the Russians kind of seem to have stuck with it, which was, this isn't an invasion, we're not going to invade, this is Western hysteria. In the meantime, try and stir up and create these sort of fake provocations, atrocities, and all this sort of stuff in eastern Donbass, in the occupied territories, and then kind of go in as a sort of under the pretense as a peacekeeping force. They just kind of stuck to this. And although it didn't, as you say, it didn't really fool many people, certainly in the military intelligence community in the West, they seem to have, in their determination to stick to this weird series of denials right to the last minute, not briefed the real plan down to the sort of tactical unit level in their own military until very, very late. I guess because they're concerned that that would be picked up and leaked, partly perhaps because of these sort of consistent US intelligence report releases. They may have been paranoid about how penetrated their system was. Yeah, maybe it does appear that a lot of the Russian units really didn't get much warning at all that they were moving from these supposed exercises and training deployments to combat operations.
I mean, I guess there's a political explanation, which is not your area of expertise so much, which might be an alternative, which is that they don't want to bombard heavily whole regions of cities, because the whole political imperative is that they're supposed to be our Russian brothers that we're coming to rescue, therefore they don't want to wipe out whole cities, and there might not be keenness within the military or within the political arms to do that. So maybe the reticence is less about competence and more about unwillingness to take that step.
It's certainly the case that the Kremlin was banking on a relatively clean, relatively quick win, and they were the plan was to use these infiltrated forces, of which they had quite a few, a couple of companies worth in Kiev, for example, and as well as throughout the country. They've had years of low-level fighting with Ukraine and plenty of time to infiltrate with their military and foreign ministry operatives and things. They were counting on being able to assassinate kind of key resistance figures, including Zelensky, Basically push up a lot of pro-Russian elements within the Ukrainian state framework that are there, and basically hope that they could create at least chaos, at best, a sort of more friendly regime in Kiev and in the regions, so that their troops could basically walk in and take over and set up a system of kind of basically repression, but fronted by Ukrainians, not Russians. Because that didn't happen, they're now faced with the issue that they have to fight their way into the cities, and they've encountered much stiffer resistance than they think. So while they certainly didn't set out with the plan to, you know, bombard and destroy Ukrainian cities, unfortunately, particularly as we're seeing at the moment in Kharkiv, you know, which is under very heavy bombardment and has been for a couple of days, and this is a predominantly Russian-speaking part of the country, you know, it's one of the areas where there were counter-protests when Yanukovych fell back in 2014. They're certainly prepared, unfortunately, yeah, and I think we're going to see it more and more in the coming days to do this, to really level places, because they're all in now. They've taken these incredible amounts of economic sanctions, huge political isolation. They've burned all of their soft power influence networks. They're going to have massive economic problems over the next year or so. So for the Kremlin, it's not enough to go, oh, well, the plan didn't work. I guess we'll go back to the start lines. They need victory. So
there's one more thing I'd love to get your expertise on, which is I want to show one video of something that circulated a lot, which is this strike in the center of Kharkiv, in the main square. And this has been referred to as evidence that they are now bombarding residential areas. Any pretense that they're only making military targets is out the window, and the kind of heavy Homs or Aleppo-style bombardment has started. But from what I could see on this video, that wasn't evidence of that. The missile seems to miss the big government building in Freedom Square in Kharkiv. It sort of takes a tiny bit of the corner of the roof off and lands squarely in the pavement in front of it. In your opinion, could that just be incompetence or a sort of missed target, or is it more likely that they meant to hit exactly that place?
I'm fairly sure they intended to hit the building square on. Cruise missiles are, generally speaking, particularly older ones like the one in the video, use sort of GPS equivalent, so GLONASS in their case. And that's accurate to kind of, to, you know, a few meters, tens of meters in their case. And so, you know, this is within rough accuracy expectations. They'll have put the coordinates in for that building, but the precise impact point, as you say, is slightly in front of it.
This TV tower that's been dominating the headlines this morning, almost every front page talks about how they have hit the TV tower, but the video doesn't really seem to show that. It just seems slightly odd, doesn't it, that if these are the two big, most publicized strikes on the big symbolic targets. We've got the main government regional office in Kharkiv, we've got the TV tower, the tallest structure in Kiev, and both of them are misses, or at least they don't take them down. So, you know, either that they're just not very good, or they didn't mean to hit them.
So they did mean to hit them, but they're basically Russia's cruise missile. I mean, any cruise missile, but particularly Russia's ones. They're about 10 years, 15 years behind the kind of latest equivalent Tomahawks or whatever from the US side. They don't give you that real precision. They allow you to hit roughly on a grid square, but it's not enough to kind of target key points on a building. Or, for example, we've seen in the latest strikes on air bases, they've mostly missed the runways. Because they don't have kind of, for example, infrared seekers that will do the kind of final home in on a particular bit. And this is partly why it's so weird that they haven't employed the air forces yet, because in any major way, because air forces do give you that much more precision, that ability to target specific areas. Even with unguided weapons, you get more precision than a cruise missile from distance. And also, compared to the US, Russia has a lot of missiles, but they've fired more than 400 so far. And that's quite a significant chunk of their inventory. They can't just keep lobbing cruise missiles. And unfortunately, as in Kharkiv, we're going to continually see an increase towards rocket artillery and conventional artillery, as well as potentially the Air Force in coming days, because their cruise missiles just aren't.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Accurate enough to do really surgical strikes, as you've shown in the two clips here, and they don't have enough of them anyway to accomplish their goals now by force. So unfortunately, we're going to see a lot more artillery coming.
Justin Bronk, thank you so much.
Thanks.
Thank you to Justin Bronk from the Royal United Services Institute, sharing some of his expertise there on the Russian military capability and trying to understand what seems to be the big mystery of this war so far. We're now on day 7, and the might of the Russian military machine has not yet been in evidence. Whether that is a political decision, whether it's some other kind of tactic, or whether, as Mr. Bronk suggested, it's actually to do with capability and coordination, remains to be seen, and I guess we will see in the coming days. Thanks to him, and thanks to you for joining. This was Unheard.